Hello and welcome to Pulsar Space Impulse's very own podcast on everything spacey. I'm Ria Urban, your host for today.
We're here today with Dr. Natasha Nicholson, one of the directors of Star Helix. Welcome, Natasha.
Hi, Victoria. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for accepting our invitation. You have a very interesting professional life, which I would love to talk about. But why don't we start with you explaining to us what Star Helix is and what you do there?
So I want to just preface this by saying that this isn't a plug for Star Helix. We're a new company and we already have some clients, so we're actually already at capacity. But just to explain what we do, we are a multidisciplinary consultancy. So there's three of us so far, with a few more sort of on the books, so to speak, who will help out as and when. But we've all got quite varied backgrounds. You'll hear about mine later, I suspect. And we've all ended up in the space sector. Now, we're not specifically looking for space clients, although we're very happy to continue with space clients. But essentially, we bring all of our different areas of expertise to bear on specific interesting problems that are brought to us. This is kind of a side gig for many of us at the moment, because we've got other jobs, or I've got another job coming up in a few months, hopefully. But it's a way of essentially letting us apply our expertise to different scenarios and interesting problems.
Right. Okay. Intriguing.
Thank
And
you.
How did little Natasha start out? Like, when you were a little girl, what did you want to be? What was a dream?
As a little girl, I wanted to be a panther, and then I realized that that wasn't possible.
That's so cute.
Yeah. And for a while I wanted to be a film director. I don't know, there were all sorts of things. Little Natasha was very confused.
Wow.
I was interested in a lot of things, and I didn't think I was very good at science. So despite doing my hardest at a biology A level, I didn't, you know, I didn't get higher than a C, whereas I didn't really try very hard with English and theology and managed to get B's in them both. So my, you know, I could have got two A's and a D, but I went for more average grades. Anyway, I ended up doing English literature at university, which was my father's recommendation. Bless him, he thought that if I did an English degree, I would be employable in any sector, because I would have proven that I could deconstruct text and write convincing arguments and so forth. And then the recession happened, and suddenly an English degree wasn't worth the paper it was written on, and all of my fellow English graduates had to go working in bars and cafes and so on, and I wasn't any different. Although I had some inheritance money from my dear late grandmother, so when I was working in a cafe, I took myself off to Australia to do that.
Oh, wow.
And I think, you know, traveling was my passion back then, and it still is to an extent. And I think my plan was just to keep working my way around the world, probably slowly trying to get out of cafes and into adventure tourism.
Yeah.
And then I came home to visit family, and my father sat me down and gave me this great sort of like, if you don't start taking life seriously, you're going to be unemployable and you have unrealistic expectations of life and so forth. So he put the fear of God in me, and I tried to get a real job with literature, which basically was in the publishing world. And I discovered that that just didn't have the right environment for me. So after much soul searching, I went to Napier University to do actually ecotourism. And I was very nervous, because the first few modules were all environmental science. And as I said, at school, I wasn't very good at science. So I thought this was going to be really very challenging for me. And then I ended up getting distinctions in my first two essays, and realized that I could do it and that I enjoyed it. And so switched to pure environmental science with conservation. And then while I was doing that, discovered that astrobiology was a subject, a legitimate subject, and switched from looking at deer populations in Scotland to looking at how tardigrades were affected by heavy metals. Tardigrades being water bears, they're little extremophiles, multicellular organisms that can survive all sorts of things by going into this particular cryptobiotic state. And then I went to an astrobiology conference and begged Charles Coquel to give me some work experience in the lab, which turned into a PhD.
Oh, wow. Okay. And your PhD is in physics and astronomy?
Technically, yes, that's the department we were in, but it was more geomicrobiology in different gravity conditions. So looking at how bacteria access nutrients from rocks for the application of biomining and how that is affected by different gravity environments to see if you could use them for in situ resource utilization on Mars or from asteroids.
Right. So you mentioned biomining. Can you explain biomining to our listeners who haven't heard of it?
Sure. So it's used industrially. It's an alternate form of extracting minerals from rocks. So you still have to break up the rocks mechanically, but then instead of using toxic chemicals and really high temperatures to separate out the mineral, i.e. copper, from the rock ore, you use bacteria who have evolved over, you know, a couple billion years to do the same task. And they do it much more efficiently, although I think marginally slower, but not massively. You put your rock, your broken down rock, into these large stir tanks or onto leach heaps, and the bacteria just chomp their way through it. And then you can separate out the mineral that you're after from the bulk solution.
All right. Okay.
And the idea is, if you wanted to do something like that in space, you could take a smaller amount of hardware up and just a few test tubes of this bacteria for redundancy. And it would, from a weight saving perspective, you know, a serious consideration when you're thinking about launch, it would be much more efficient.
Sure. Right. And were you excited about biomining, or was it something else that interested you?
Honestly, it had never occurred to me growing up that I could work even adjacent to the space sector. So suddenly coming in to this lab group and being offered a position on a European Space Agency project to put something on the International Space Station completely blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, walking on clouds, and I realized that even if I won the lottery, I would still want to be doing what I was doing. It was so exciting for me. And yes, I mean, I think I particularly like the fact that it was application focused as well.
Sure. Right. Now, after that, how did you end up with Space Scotland as a cluster manager?
That was a great job. but I had a few great jobs, actually. So while I was finishing up my PhD, I joined an organization called the UK Space Environments Association, which had been set up through a UK Space Agency working group to essentially help bring together information relevant to different people in space-related disciplines. So I worked on the newsletter for that, and I put quite a lot of effort into it. And I suppose that was visible to some of the other people on the committee, because they suggested me for a job down in Harwell, working on basically managing the proof of concept grant that the STFC were doing down there. And I did a decent job at that. So they hired me full time as their cross-cluster liaison manager. So I was essentially working at the interface of the space cluster, the health tech cluster, and the energy tech cluster, bringing people together, finding out what everyone was doing and recommending solutions to problems, and also managing a larger grant. It was fascinating, honestly.
Yeah, I can imagine. Right. Okay, and now you are not with Space Scotland anymore.
Oh, I see. So yes, after that, I mean, essentially it was one of the best jobs I could have imagined, but I didn't, I mean, from a work culture perspective, you know, Harwell's quite remote, and at the end of the day, everyone would disperse to the sort of, you know, four corners of Oxfordshire and beyond. So there wasn't much in the way of a kind of, I guess, community. I mean, there was a community on site, but only sort of during events and stuff. So I decided to move back to Scotland, where I'd always felt closer to the culture up in Scotland. So moved back up, worked at a university for a while, helping promote. So that was at Heriot Watt, helping promote the Research Futures Academy and helping researchers do continuous professional development and running a research festival and bringing together. So I also worked on European Crucible, which was bringing together scientists from across Scotland and into Europe to create multidisciplinary research groups, basically.
Right.
And then I was headhunted for the role at Space Scotland to help build the cluster up here, which was already, you know, fairly well established, but it was rebranding and getting resourcing for the first time. So I helped kind of reinforce some of the existing relationships, reach out into neighboring sectors, promote the cluster internationally, inputted to sort of strategic government groups, ran the working groups around our skills, and helped out with the environmental task force, the upstream working group. I mean, there were a lot of working groups and they all do amazing things. I was just sort of helping to keep them all going. The New Voices in Space working group did some excellent work. And then I won a bunch of funding from the UK Space Agency to do new projects and designed those projects with partners and started delivering them before I left.
Well done. Wow. It sounds amazing.
It was fantastic. And I have to say, the community, the space community in Scotland is wonderful. You know, everything that I'd hoped for and more. Really friendly people. Most of them really open to collaboration. It was fun. It's fun being at conferences with everyone.
Yeah. I missed you at a few conferences, I believe. And then we finally met in last November. And I'm glad we did.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
You had amazing shoes on. That's what I remember. Really, really shiny silver shoes, I think. Yeah.
Partly silver and shiny and partly grey and suede, if I remember.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, shoes. Yeah. No. All I remember is shiny and fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right, so you're not with Space Scotland anymore.
No, they've now got an excellent executive director, and someone else is going to be running the UKSA project. So I thought I would try and move more into the biotechnology area again, you know, back towards my PhD.
That makes sense, absolutely. So what does the future hold for Dr. Natasha Nicholson?
Well, that's an excellent question. I don't suppose any of us can see that far into the future, but I'm going to America next month to hopefully get some work experience and or make connections around a couple of analog astronaut facilities. I'll be going to, I'm going with someone who's going to be an analog astronaut on high seas, and then I'm hopefully going to Arizona to speak to the Biosphere 2 folk in Arizona, all of whom have excellent, they in particular in Arizona have excellent history of developing closed environment systems for life support.
Right.
After that, there's a job that I've been waiting on and I'm not allowed to speak about it, which is quite frustrating, and the start date is also a bit uncertain, so it's a bit of a risk I feel I'm taking, which is one of the reasons I started Star Helix, so that, you know, we'd have some I would have a toe still in employment.
Sure.
And also so that I could help other people. I mean, I've got two other directors now who are in a similar position. You know, they've got one of them has an excellent job and she's not planning on leaving that, but she wants to kind of contribute to other projects as she goes. And then yes, the other director is also between jobs, but has been headhunted by a launch provider in the US. So he's just waiting to hear about that.
Exciting. Wow. Right. You mentioned the Scottish space sector and how great it is, how friendly the people are. How small is the Scottish space sector, or how big?
Well, interestingly, the Scottish space sector actually represents 20% of the UK's space workforce. So in that respect, it's by ratio, it's quite large. But, you know, you're probably talking somewhere between 60 and 80 fully sort of space specific companies, and then other companies that are, you know, work with space or are part of the space supply chain, but don't exclusively serve space. Currently, most of that is around small satellite development. There are some launch providers who are developing their technologies. There are some spaceports under construction. And then Earth observation forms a large part of the Scottish space sector as well.
Sure. All right. And how do you see the future of the Scottish space sector? Is it going in the right direction? Are there going to be huge changes needed?
Well, I think generally it's going in the right direction. There are some concerns around, essentially around some of the venture capitalists and how they might have overvalued some of the companies. But I'd like to think we can overcome that. And again, in general, we're definitely moving in the right direction, I'd say. I mean, we're soon going to be the first European country to have a full end-to-end value proposition in terms of sort of satellite design and manufacture through launch to the use of the data, which I think is a really great story. And I know our politicians have been talking about it quite a lot on the international stage. But then we are also reaching out into other sectors as well. There's some quite interesting developments around using space data for financial services. Photonics, there's a great pool of expertise in Scotland, and they've got working with Scotland IS or Scotland IS. I was never quite sure how to pronounce that. There's a lot of activity going on for photonics for space with Space Scotland as well. And then Scotland's National Robotarium, or the UK's National Robotarium, I should say, which is an initiative between Edinburgh University and Heriot-Watt University. They've expressed quite a strong interest in space, and robotics is obviously very key. I would like to see, obviously, Scotland's strengths in biotechnology and agriculture being brought into the space sector for life support systems, because I think that's going to be a huge thing moving forward, especially as NASA are retiring the International Space Station at the end of the decade. And there are currently 4 or 5 projected commercial space stations that will be going up. And obviously there's a huge focus now towards lunar colonization and eventually Mars as a destination. And if you're going further afield in low Earth orbit, you have to be more self-reliant. You have to be able to use what you've got without lots of waste and without resupplies of consumables. So it's an interesting challenge. And I think that, you know, the market for that will be growing.
Right. Yeah. I just have an interesting question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've heard about it. I just heard about it a few weeks ago, I think. So there's evidently a fungus that they want to use as protection from radiation, because there's something in the fungus that absorbs cosmic radiation. So if they got it onto the ISS, the outside of the ISS, it would protect the astronauts there from radiation. Do you know anything about it? Have you heard about this?
Yeah, it's funny you should bring that up, actually, okay. Especially if we didn't talk about this pre-interview. Actually, the other director, the other female director of Star Helix is basically in the group. She's the sort of business facing side of a company that's developing that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
This is a good question then. Yay.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's talked to me about it in confidence, and I'm not sure how much of that is I'm allowed to talk about. So I'll just say, yes, it's a very exciting technology. If I get this job that I'm waiting to hear about, I would love to work with them, but it seems like they've already got interest from some other big space companies. So I don't know if my new job will start in time to snap them up, or if someone else is going to do that in the interim.
Right. This is just so amazing that we might have the solution on Earth that we need in space. This is
honestly, evolution has been working such miracles. I mean, okay, that's a bit of an oxymoron, but yeah, evolution has done some really amazing things with biology. And I mean, I talked about tardigrades before. I ended up moving away from tardigrade research and into, you know, microbiology. And whilst tardigrades are microscopic, they're still multicellular eukaryotes. So, you know, I was looking at prokaryotes. I don't know what you might be able to take out of tardigrade DNA, but synthetic biology also means that you can start inputting genes into microbes to get them to produce different nutrients or compounds. You know, you can use algae to produce materials, food, to purify air, to purify water, clean waste. I mean, they're microscopic machines, and you can program them. I mean, it's really amazing.
That is amazing. Would it work the same way in microgravity, and, you know, in a larger amount of cosmic radiation than on Earth? Because, you know, you test something on Earth, then you send it to the ISS, and it might work out very differently. So do you test these things here and then send it into space to test
it? Yes, ideally, yeah. And you're right, you know, the zero gravity environment does change things. However, on a microorganism scale, they don't directly sense gravity. They're too small. The other forces at that scale dominate over gravity, but it will still change the liquid environment that they're in.
Yeah.
So density-driven forces in water change. I mean, well, they disappear, basically. So you have to consider that very carefully when you're doing your engineering designs. As for cosmic radiation, again, some organisms have incredible adaptations, like Deinococcus radiodurans is the most famous. That one can survive radiation at quite extremely high levels compared to most living organisms. So yes, with synthetic biology, you might be able to overcome some of those problems. Although again, most of these environments will be shielded. Potentially one day with the fungi you mentioned, but and then one other interesting thing about the space environment is it does actually accelerate mutations. In plants and microorganisms, and some companies are using that to find new and useful mutations that can be put into existing organisms as well.
See, again, this reminds me of something that I read. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I think it was flatworms, but I'm not really sure. But they sent to the ISS. I'm not sure what it was. I know I wouldn't touch it. I don't know what it was. Anyway, so they cut the tail off, and instead of growing the tail back, which would normally happen on Earth, if you cut the tail off, it would just grow it back. On the ISS, it grew a second head.
Yeah.
And that happens like one in a million, maybe on Earth. But on the ISS, one in 15 grew a second head, which is like scary. That's a scary mutation.
Yes, and mutation is a word that has very negative connotations. You know, you tend to think about cancer or, you know, three-eyed fish or whatever. But you know, again, mutation is how evolution works. It's random mutation that leads to advantages. So I suppose humans are now acting as an evolutionary force as well. Selective breeding has, you know, we've been doing that for millennia.
See, I have exciting questions now. I love that you know about this stuff. So if we were to go to Mars and colonize Mars and have Martians born, how do you think they would differ from people on Earth? And would they be able to come back to Earth? Well, not back, because they've never been here, but would they be able to survive on Earth if they're born on Mars in that environment? Because I imagine that, I don't know, their heads would be bigger because, you know, the gravity is different there. Maybe they would be thinner. I don't know.
So there are lots of science fiction books that have explored this. I think my favorite that's explored what you're talking about specifically is probably The Expanse.
Oh yeah, I heard about that just a few days ago. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great TV show as well, but I suspect the books go into more detail and they're on my reading list. So I don't think genetically they would be that different, at least not for the first, you know, few thousand, 100,000 years. But you're right, you know, growing up with less gravity, I mean, just being in lower gravity environments is bad for your bones, and zero G environments are not great for things like your circulatory system, your eyeballs, all sorts. But if you've got some gravity, it's still better than no gravity. And I think, you know, you'd probably want them to. I don't know. You're right. If you grow up on Mars, then Earth gravity would seem quite extreme. But again, I think, you know, you could get used to it. You'd maybe need some preparation before coming down, weight training and that sort of thing. I don't know. It's really not my area of expertise, but it is fun to think about. I don't know if their heads would get bigger. That seems unlikely to me.
I was just thinking because, you know, they have the puffy face and chicken leg syndrome when they go to space because all the fluids shift in the body. So that's why I imagine they would have not like ginormous heads, but slightly bigger than ours. So
right, I was thinking specifically about skull size and stuff.
No, sorry. I meant
puffier faces.
Okay, puffy heads, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, that's better. That's the scientific term, puffy heads.
Yeah, puffy heads, all right.
Okay, would you, if you had the chance to go to the moon or Mars or just in space anywhere, would you do it?
100%.
Wow, you didn't even think.
Nope.
Isn't it scary?
I mean, you know, different things scare different people. I'm scared by spiders and emotional intimacy. Lol.
be another show.
But throwing myself out of an airplane or abseiling down the side of a cliff or, you know, walking across hot coals, those are all things I've done and just been kind of psyched about. Going into space would, well, I haven't been into space. I've been into microgravity. That was amazing. I would definitely go into space. I don't mind. I mean, you know, you could get hit by a car at any point sort of thing. So you don't want to let fear stop you doing those things if you can avoid it.
True. Wow. Okay. Cool. So space is not scary for you. It's just exciting.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a dangerous place. It's a hazardous environment. Lots of things could go wrong. And I'm sure that psychologically, if I was out there for a really long time, it would probably get to me. Unless there was, you know, like a good little, kind of nature pod somewhere on there, somewhere on the ship or the space station or the habitat. They're probably looking out into the gulf, the endless dark expanse of space probably would be existentially challenging, but I'm up for it.
Okay. All right. I'll tell NASA that you're waiting.
Thanks.
Speaking
Probably commercial astronaut is a more likely route for
Yeah,
me.
probably. Okay. Well, I'll call Elon Musk, don't worry. Right. So since we're on the subject, you mentioned going to Hawaii and Arizona, right?
Yeah.
Are you going to come back to Scotland afterwards, or you don't know, not sure? So where will you end up? Is it
My
too
heart is in Scotland.
Okay.
This is, you know, I moved around a lot as a kid, and I didn't grow up in Scotland, but my family is Scottish, and I did all my tertiary education here, and it feels like home to me. And there's a lot of exciting things happening in America. I'd be happy to work over there for a bit and then bring my, you know, skills back to Scotland. But for me, helping Scotland's space sector and developing these new skills in Scotland is quite important for me.
Sure. That's nice. Right. One more question I have about the environmental task force that you are still a part of, I guess. You helped with the roadmap, the sustainability roadmap for Scotland. Is that right?
No, actually, I think that was pretty much mostly written and completed by the time I joined Space Scotland. But what I've been doing since then is helping them to implement it.
Okay. Do you think that's really a useful document? It's going to help the Scottish space sector, but not just that, but maybe other countries can, you know, look at it as an example.
Absolutely. And in fact, other countries already are. So I know that Australia has been liaising with Scotland. They're very keen to be more environment, or at least the people we've been speaking to have been very keen to make the space sector more environmentally friendly. I do think it's a useful document. I think, you know, there is a real risk of greenwashing, and we're all nervous of being accused of that. But also, you know, you have to start somewhere, and having clear tasks with, you know, people assigned to them and progress checks and so on is, you know, an efficient way of getting things done. And if other countries can see the route you're taking and that it's working, then they can either design their own more specific roadmap for their country, or they can borrow from ours. I mean, everyone needs to do as much as they can, is what it comes down to. And I think, you know, the roadmap provides at least some transparency on what we're up to and what our goals are. And yeah, it was one of the most interesting things for me is, obviously, because my master's was in environmental science, and I do feel guilty sometimes that I walked away from climate change and got distracted by the exciting shininess of space. And, you know, I do worry that I've become part of the problem, but also I think that in the long run, space is an important part of the solution, and not just from an Earth observation perspective, but everything I'm doing, everything I want to do around agriculture for space, using vertical farming and technology and all of that, I'm hoping we'll be able to tie directly back to Earth, and that by expanding our habitat, not trying to find Earth point two or whatever, because, you know, however bad we make this planet, it's still going to be more habitable than Mars.
Sure.
This is our home planet. There isn't another one within light years. Then tens of light years, we don't, you know, we haven't found a similar exoplanet yet. There's been lots of Earth-like exoplanets, but they're all, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we evolved for this planet. This is our home. We've got to fix it. And if expanding into space helps relieve the strain on the biosphere, then fantastic. And if some of our technology that we're developing for space is closed loop environmental systems, I mean, that's the kind of thing we need here on Earth, is less waste, more efficiency. So I think they go hand in hand.
Less waste, more efficiency. I like that.
Yes.
Okay. Let there be that. That's a beautiful sentence to close this interview with. And I would just like to thank you for accepting our invite again and teaching us about astrobiology and environmental things in space and on Earth as well. And we wish you all the best. And I hope to interview you again when you become the president, or I don't know, something on Mars or a moon colony. I can really see you.
Heavy skepticism on this side, but anytime. And I know that I'll catch you for a drink soon as well.
Right. Okay. Thank you for the interview.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you for listening, and join us next time for more.